We actually produce more revenue because we reduced the price than if we had left it the way it was before, which is kind of a little bit counterintuitive, but that's just kind of, we saw such an increase in volume in the network. We're now the third largest DEX in the world in terms of volume. We went from like, you know, number 10 or 12, whatever the number was, to like 3 because of the efficiency of this.
Hey everyone, I have the fantastic pleasure of once again speaking with the one and only Chad of the Thunder, Chad Bereford of Thorchain. How's it going, man? I kind of
the Thunder's Thorchain, yeah.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a self-censor, you know, those who know, but whatever. So
we spoke at first time some point in 2021, I think. It was during the ChaosNet days, and I do remember... It's, as I mentioned many times before, I just did not care about DeFi at all until I heard about Thorchain and started using it. And now I care a good deal about DeFi, but outside of the cross-chain ecosystem, almost not at all still. It's still like, it made sense that this is a real thing. And so I've been kind of following this thing for many years, and I do remember the Great Rune price up and then price down, and then just all like the haters coming out saying, you know, second page coin market cap, shit coin, all that kind of stuff. Despite, you know, I don't like to say I have faith in things, but I just saw the whole way through the product is something that is really useful and no one else is doing, kind of. Now there's some other people trying to do it, but like, in I guess to a certain extent, this kind of thing was like inevitable, though it might have come a little sooner than I was had in my mental mind. I just think that things can take a while. But, yep. You know, apparently a lot of hard work's been going on. So just first, do you want to just recap what's been going on with Thorchain over the last, let's just say, 6 months, like as far as like growth and where we're at now?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the last six-ish months, we released like 3 major features. One was what we call savers, where you can earn single asset yield. So Bitcoin, ETH, AVAX, you know, Doge, and a bunch of other assets. And that was great because it's like basically the same thing what people were doing for BlockFi, right? Where BlockFi, you could deposit some Bitcoin, you get a little Bitcoin yield, and then you walk later with more Bitcoin than you had before. With there's no IL risk, no price exposure to multiple assets like you would as an AMM. And so that was a big feature. That was huge. And that's helped to like build up our depths, right? To get deeper pools, which is nice, obviously. The second thing we did was streaming swaps. And streaming swaps was just a very highly capital efficient way to do trading on an AMM. And it's become so effective and so capital efficient that just over the weekend, some guy threw a $6 million trade, which is like the largest trade we've ever seen on the protocol, $6 million from Bitcoin to WBDC. And the WBDC pool was only $4 million deep, right? There's literally, the trade is larger than the pool itself, which is like, you never see this on AMMs because anybody who would do that would get absolutely wrecked. Like you would just like pay, even if you had concentrated liquidity up the fucking ass, you would still pay up the wazoo so hard that nobody would ever do it. But on this trade, because of streaming swaps, he traded and he only paid 45 bips on that massive trade, even on a tiny pool that's smaller than the actual trade itself. Like that's just like a crazy notion. That just kind of goes to show how efficient that system is and that design is.
Yeah. So on that kind of subject, which, you know, makes sense. But something that I think a lot of people, again, maybe there might be a lot of crypto boomers who watch my channel, but if there's only 4 million worth of WBTC value in the pool, which is, you know, half of that of WBTC, the other half of Rune, where did he get more WBTC than was in the system? Like, where did that come from? It's like,
yeah. So
sorry for the boomer question, but I'm trying to.
Right. No, that's a good question to ask.
People who don't know are going to ask for sure.
Right. So what streaming swap does is it like you have a large trade and it breaks it up into like kind of smaller trades or sub swaps. Right. So in this particular case, I think he did like, I want to say it was like 3,000 sub swaps within that one large transaction. And so as he's doing a sub swap, an arbitrage bot will arbitrage in the other direction. So he's putting in Bitcoin and he's taking out WBTC. And then an R bot is putting in WBTC and taking out Bitcoin, theoretically, right? And so as his trade is being executed, the WBTC is being reimbursed into that pool. So there's like, effectively, there's like an infinite supply of WBTC in the pool, just because as you're trading it, people are putting it back in, right? And so you exit and go back in, exit goes back in, exit goes back in. And so because of that, there's always more WBTC to be had on each little sub swap that the network was executing on his behalf.
Yeah, and so the liquidity pools are just the liquidity allocated, but that doesn't, it's kind of like hash rate with like Bitcoin, for example, where the total available hash rate, if all the mining machines in the world were turned on, is like exponentially higher than the amount of hash rate that's being used at that current time, because that's what's profitable. But so probably right. if this person tried to trade half the whole market cap of WBTC, they'd probably run into some problems, because there wouldn't be enough arbing to, there wouldn't be enough, you know, exogenous liquidity to be able to come in and balance out the price again.
Well, hypothetically, if he were to trade like half the value of the WBTC, like say you were did instead of 6 million, let's call it 400 million, just to get mm-hmm. just to get crazy here. Theoretically, what would happen is you would be selling Bitcoin and you'd be buying WBTC. So you're pushing down the Bitcoin price and you're pushing up the WBTC price, because that's the one that you're exiting with. And then on the markets of WBTC itself, where you can buy WBTC and sell it to Bitcoin in the reverse direction on other markets. So like WBTC itself, like BitGo, I think, is the one that manages WBTC. And so they would start arbing on their side. And so I think it would actually theoretically work. Though wouldn't, in our case, we don't allow such a massive trade. Like if you can't execute the trade within 24 hours, it wouldn't even allow it, because we don't want to store large quantities of like $200 million outside of the security of the network. So we don't actually allow something like that. Would take, you know, probably a week or two, right, to execute this kind of trade and still be able to get, you know, 45 bips or something very small. You could do it a lot faster if you want to and pay more in fees. That's kind of the trade-off you're doing here. Do you want something faster and more expensive, or slower and less expensive? And you can kind of like, you know, go as far to one side or the other side as you want to, depending on your case and scenario.
Yeah. And so if hypothetically Satoshi came back, you know, not you, Craig Wright, but Satoshi came back and decided to want to be a Dogecoin maxi now. And he just decides he's going to take all his stash and put it through streaming swaps. But first off, he'd probably be there for months just getting it through. But then just the entire rest of the crypto ecosystem would be scrambling to just throw liquidity into and out of the pools just to keep that thing going.
Right. And so the question becomes like, how fast can ARBs ARB, right? Mm-hmm. And even at a large volume like that. And so, I mean, if somebody was actually doing that, it would take a long time, but people would start adding liquidity to the pool, because there's obviously a huge volume that's passing through it that people would want to participate in, because they want to get that juicy yield there. And so the pool would naturally become a lot deeper than it is now. If you actually were trying to push through ridiculous quantities of funds, you know, buying Doge or some other asset, it would be fascinating to watch it. Like, it'd be like more exciting than watching a Red Sox game, in my opinion, to do that. Than
you'd sell tickets.
I'd sell tickets to the thing and live stream it. Like, it'd be kind of fun to see all the like the volume passing through it and the arms trying to push. And then like you got conf counting to worry about. And like, that's the other thing is like, if you are back on the Doge, Doge doesn't have as much security as, you know, Bitcoin, for obvious reasons. And so the number of conf counting that you would have to do, so it matters how fast he's trying to get the value through. If he's trying to like shotgun it and just like, you know, push it through in a very short period of time, he would push the price up like crazy, you know, doing so, which is what we saw over the weekend when somebody else who stole a bunch of money shotgun a bunch of value in a very short period of time and pushed the Bitcoin price like up to $50,000 through, which was crazy because he just put so much value in such a, like, they didn't care about like best execution. There's like, just get it through as fast as possible. And so ARBs were just like trying hard to ARB the other direction, but there's just so much value in a short period of time. If that person was like more price sensitive and they just decided to trade over a longer period of time, then they would have had a much better execution.
Yeah. So they had like, was Ethereum or something and wanted Bitcoin. Is that how it shaped out?
Yep.
Now, this is, I guess, is a very small tangent, but and it's a lot of speculation about like criminal activity and stuff. But like, to me, that doesn't make sense, so much sense, that you have Ethereum and then you want to get away with it and you put it to Bitcoin. I guess is that because of there's more fiat on ramps and the dark and like local markets and stuff to like something real.
My assumption is that the people like this would just push it into like Wasabi Wallet or Samurai Wallet or one of these like mixers on Bitcoin, and then later on, because they use this kind of mixer in the middle of it all, they would, you know, go to some exchange. And because Bitcoin is very, very fluid, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of liquidity in Bitcoin. There's lots of exchanges you could go to. They could theoretically like take that Bitcoin, put a little bit of Coinbase, a little bit to the Binance, a little bit to OKX, a little bit to this one, a little bit to that one, you know, or even create fake KYCs, right? Fake identities, and like start siphoning large quantities through them or OTC desks. Like you would probably be even probably more utilized if it was me and I was trying to do this. I would probably go through an OTC desk because it's more, I can get a better execution as well as have better privacy probably in some sense, I guess, maybe. I don't know. You can do larger volumes of OTC for sure though.
Yeah, it does make, it doesn't, what would make more sense maybe is if you run ETH through the Railgun smart contract, then you get basically Zcash level privacy, which is way better than anything you can get on Bitcoin. But then on the other hand, you got to pay those ETH fees on top of this contract. You might just like lose so much money. It's just easier to swap. Although if you do the swap, then you lose a lot of money. I don't know. I mean, I've never been a thief, so I don't understand the the mental, like, what are you trying to do? And like, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure. It's not like you're just sitting down with like a pencil being like, if I launder this way, it's like, you know, but it is kind of funny to me where people use Thorchain sometimes as a to get privacy or something when I don't think it's a good tool for that, honestly. But that's a different discussion. But so about the streaming swaps thing, just the last little point on that. So it's made it much more capital efficient for sure. Now, what are the effects on the actual liquidity pools as far as, do you see people taking money out of the pools because now it's a lot cheaper to trade through it, so they're not getting as much in fees? Do you actually see fee revenues like significantly go down for the pools? Like how do the dynamics, is it just the same but just a much smaller percentage of liquidity for the amount of volume that's needed? Like how does it shake out in the real world?
Yeah, so that was a big debate we had internally before launching the feature. Was that like, obviously we are opting to pay less fees for value, but we were also like, we wouldn't see trades larger than like $10,000, right? I mean, sometimes we see like $250,000, but like for the most part, 99% of trades were like, you know, 10K or less, right? So we weren't seeing huge volumes because it doesn't make a lot of financial sense to trade on Thorchain pre-stream swaps for like a large quantity of value. And so the question was, okay, if we reduce fees, we will obviously get less income because of that, but we'll also get more trading, right? We'll have whales come in with $1 million trades or $6 million trades, to use the number we were talking about before. And obviously they're going to pay 5 bips on a $6 million trade, which is obviously, you know, not a small amount of money, obviously. And so the question became like, if we reduce the kind of the prices, so to speak, and we get more volume, does the volume off put the pricing, right? Mm. And in reality, it actually did. And we actually produced more revenue because we reduced the price than if we had left it the way it was before, which is kind of a little bit counterintuitive, but that's just kind of, we saw such an increase in volume in the network. Mm. We're now the third largest DEX in the world in terms of volume. We went from like, you know, number 10 or 12, whatever the number was, to like 3 because of the efficiency of this, because we have better price execution than every centralized exchange and decentralized exchange for these assets. And so that just created a lot more volume. And the volume is obviously creating a lot more income. So we're getting less money per swap, in a matter of speaking, but we have a lot more swaps, and that kind of counteracts it.
Yeah, so that's almost like the big blocker scaling kind of argument of like, oh, if you do, instead of like $5 per Bitcoin transaction, if you do 50 cents, be just 10 times as many, you know, kind of equals out. But kind of on that note, this is a big system.
It actually kind of reminds me, like, in the early days of, like, Xbox and the first Xbox, like, box, like, back in, whatever, 2001, whatever year that was. Like, they sold the Xbox for less than the cost of the hardware, right? They took the hit because they were trying to get market saturation, right? As a company, Microsoft was trying to, just like, they want to make sure that the price was small, that they got as many people to own Xboxes as possible, so that when the games would come out, there'd be more buying of those games and be more profitable for the game manufacturers. Yeah. So that was just like a long-term kind of strategy of like, well, let's not go for profit right now. Let's just get for market saturation. And we are kind of doing the same thing of like, let's go for market saturation. Let's get as much trade volume as we can. Let's get much integrations as we can. I mean, ThorSwap had $150,000 of income, just the UI. In a single weekend, which is just like, that's more money than Uniswap had made in the weekend. I mean, it's crazy to think. But by doing so, these UIs are like making a lot of money, which incentivizes more UIs to connect to ThorChain because they can make a lot of money. And so like, you're just trying to like spread out and get as much, you know, integrations and value, you know, accrual from other people coming into you that the less in price in terms of swap fees is like, not even a thing.
Yeah. I mean, that is pretty, the alignment of the incentives kind of is something that's really kind of interesting to behold on that stuff. But so we're talking about like scaling, right? So now we're talking about raw scaling of the system, not just how do we scale up the economy, or Thor economy, as it were. But like this, I'm sure if everyone is thrown in streaming swaps and there's little beep, 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 little like internal transactions and things going from all these things, at some point, something's going to get, you know, there's a lot of load. So how is scaling like the actual network looking? What are some challenges? Like, are you starting to get congested, or is it close? At what point of volume do you think it would get close and all that stuff?
Yeah. So, like the network's ability to do swaps, that is quite efficient. I don't think we have much concern around that right now, to be honest with you. Where we see kind of like the edges get a little bit rough is in the scenario where, like in this past weekend, where somebody tried to just shotgun $20 million or $30 million or how the amount was in a very short period of time. And by doing so, the ARBs could not ARB as fast as the shotgun guy was like pushing tens of millions of dollars through the network. And that's where you see like kind of the edges kind of show. So it's not a good thing when the pool price disconnects from the market price, right? If the Bitcoin price on the network is $50,000 and the market price is, you know, 35 or whatever the number is, right? So that's not necessarily a good thing, obviously. And what you need is you want ARBs to be ARBing. Right. And there's a few problems with this that we have to deal with. For one, conf counting, right? You can't just submit a Bitcoin transaction to, you know, ARB the situation and, you know, instantly have that put through and blah, blah, blah. You have to wait for confs to count. And that conf counting can be problematic. I think like some of these transactions, I saw like a conf count as high as like 36 because of the way we do conf counting. So we'll be 36 is like, I think 6 hours, something like this, right? 34, 36 blocks. Yeah. So that's one thing that I do is kind of like, is putting, we're changing the way conf counting works to be a bit more aggressive, right? That's the first part. Then the second part is we have a system called delayed outbound, right? And that's specifically inherently, purposely creating a delay on the outbound of transactions just to create an opportunity for the network to resolve any kind of like hack or exploit that's happening. We actually added that years ago from Quesantes. And so that delays outbounds. But if you're going to delay outbounds, well, then, you know, up to 1 hour, then you got another hour before the ARB bot gets their money back. They put in Bitcoin, they're getting out, you know, Ethereum on the other side, and they kind of wait another hour before they can like go through Binance, get some more Bitcoin and put it through like another kind of loop through the system in a sense. But if you have to wait another hour, it's obviously reduces the effectiveness of the ARB bot, right? And so right now, just like we want to get it so that you can get in, do your swap, and get out as fast as possible. Because the faster that can do that, the more efficient and the more powerful ARBs will be to maintain that price.
Yeah, it's so. But as far as like network level scaling, does the ThorChain network kind of like run into scaling problems at some point, or what can kind of be done?
I mean, everything has limits, right?
Of course.
So at some point, the Switch network would have scaling issues. I don't think that's going to be anytime soon, just because. Excuse me. I don't think it'll be anytime soon because there's only so many transactions you can have on Ethereum, and there's only so many transactions you can have on Bitcoin. And that's like, you know, 80% of the volume right there. So unless you're seeing massive like volume passing through Binance Smart Chain and like, you know, AVAX and these types of chains that are like really fast finality, very quick, you know, blocks, these kind of things, you're probably not going to run into that issue just because you just cannot have enough swaps happening on Bitcoin to like, because there's just not enough block space, right?
Yeah, so more like the scaling problems hit the chains being traded on more than Thorchain itself.
Right. That's really the Thorchain is a Cosmos chain, and it can do a lot of transactions fairly quickly. So it's already highly pretty efficient. It's probably not as efficient as like Fire Dancer on Solana, or whatever. But like, it's still more than we need, to be honest with you. And we have ideas, something called block efficiency even furthermore, and reduce the transactions by like 100 or 200x, so like just to reduce the load on it. But right now that's not the bottleneck. The bottleneck right now is the conf counting and the that delayed outbound I mentioned, and then the third thing is threshold signatures and getting those to sign a lot of transactions in a short period of time. That's the third thing we have to work on.
Yeah, I saw a nice thread from Familiar Cow on this stuff, talking about also like batching outbounds, just like centralized exchanges do, and then Swapper clout, which from my understanding is just if some swapper does a lot of volume, then their kind of like verification level goes up in using a CeFi term, right? Where they could then do more trading with less delay between kind of stuff.
Right.
How does the swapper clout thing, like, it seems like you're building it. That's at that point, that's like a reputation system almost.
Yep. It's like a decentralized identity, in a matter of speaking.
Yeah. And are there any problems with like trying to form an identity around a specific wallet, or there's, you know, maybe someone wants to use a different wallet. So if they want privacy, then they end up like sacrificing their ability to cut to the front of the line for they sacrifice their VIP status if they want privacy and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Swapper Clout is generally a tool for most people, unless you're like a super heavy power user or you're an ArbBot. Mm-hmm. It's really more geared towards the ArbBots more than anything else. And by doing so, the ArbBots get to exit the system faster, which makes them more efficient, which is good, but also makes the delayed outbound less for everybody else who's not an ArbBot, or anybody who's just like a random one-time swapper on some one of these UIs that 20 so UIs that use Thorchain. So in the end, it should make the system faster for everybody, even if you're not somebody that has a huge volume in your history.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. So one thing that when you're talking about ThorSwap making all this money and stuff, ThorSwap was, of course, the center of a controversy because of the processing a lot of hacked funds and then going offline temporarily and then coming back with allegedly, I guess, some extra chain analysis kind of stuff to make sure that they're watching on who's swapping and what and stuff like that. And that's become, it kind of feels like almost like nothing. It's like very smooth. Almost nothing seems to have happened from like a distance. But at the same time, it did raise a ton of like questions about censorship of the system and all that kind of stuff. So first, just on ThorSwap specifically, do you have any specific take on what happened with that?
Well, so ThorSwap is a separate team to Thorchain,
yes,
right? Like, so I'm not involved with ThorSwap personally.
I'm also friendly with it. Like, it's not something the team could have controlled, but like, there's so many Thor names out there, including Thor names. You know, there's so many Thor everything, ThorSwap, Thor Wallet, Thorchain, and all that. Yeah. Like, together is just like it's the same entity, kind of like, you know, Tornado Cash, Uniswap, Uniswap. It gets confusing. And at least there's no like,
it does.
There's no Maya front end. There's no Maya swap. As soon as there is one, that's going to be a nightmare. But whatever.
Well, the Thor name is not You know, it's not copyrighted or any way, mm-hmm. so I don't really own it. I don't think anybody actually does. And somebody wants to use it for their own purposes, I don't really have a problem with it. And I can see the issue of, like, you know, if something happens to ThorSwap, you know, then it looks bad on ThorChain because everybody associates those two things to be the same. In reality, they're not. They're just two separate teams building two separate projects that have a relationship with each other. But, like, in my opinion, I think what ThorSwap did, I think they did the right thing. They are a centralized UI. That's always been true. That's never been, you know, said otherwise. Just most UIs in general are very much centralized. And so it's not worth it for them to say, you know, we're going to stand with, you know, North Korea or whatever the hell it is. You know what I mean? Or the FTX hacker. And, you know, we love them so much that we're going to, like, risk, you know, jail or imprisonment so that the FTX hacker can, like, get away with his stolen funds. This makes no sense. Like, nobody likes the FTX hacker, obviously, and nobody approves of such things. And it's really not worth it to go to jail over that, you know. So it's better to, you can either shut down the whole thing or, you know, implement this TRM system. And I think they made the right choice, to be honest with you. I think long-term, the industry needs to solve this problem. Long-term, the industry needs to solve, like, how do we decentralize UIs? Because we don't really do that today. Very, very few UIs have actually accomplished this. And the ones that even have accomplished it haven't done a particularly good job of it, to be honest with you. And that's, like, another project I'm working on called Archeo is working on that. How do we fully decentralize the UI? And here's, like, the hint. This is how you actually accomplish the task, right? Is that the reason why a smart contract is so decentralized, it's not because of the validator set and all this other stuff. That's a contributing factor for sure. But the reason why it's that, you know, it's decentralized is because somebody can deploy a smart contract on Ethereum and then the developer can walk away and get hit by a car. And the whole thing continues to operate. There's no, the developer does not need to continue to pay money over time to, in order for this thing to continue to operate and exist, right?
Yeah.
That's how UIs work. You have to, like, I as a developer have to build a UI. I have to buy a domain. I have to continue to buy that domain. I have to host servers. I have to pay for bandwidth, blah, 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 blah. But on a smart contract, you don't have to pay for any of those things. Why? Because the people pay for those things themselves. I pay for gas when I interact with a smart contract. I'm the one paying for it to continue to operate, not the dev who deployed the contract. And so we need UIs to adhere to that mentality of, like, you need to, as a developer, you need to be able to deploy a UI and walk the fuck away, and the whole thing will continue to operate for more or less eternity.
Yeah, it's like kind of like an open source type thing. You just open source your UI, then people use it. They're probably still going to use yours and give you the affiliate fee or whatever. But then if it gets censored for whatever reason, someone else just runs the exact same thing and can do it, for example.
Well, you can't censor it because everybody would just be running their own. Like, once I download a copy of that code, that source code, and I'm running that UI, it's mine. And nothing can change it other than the government coming on my door and knocking on it. But they wouldn't even know that I'm using it. In the way that I've designed the thing for Archeo, it has much more privacy. So nobody would even know that you even have it, let alone that you're using it.
Yeah. And so it's like bit by bit, we're kind of like chopping away the little strings to the centralized world where, you know, first you need exchanges for everything. And
right.
Then, well, you don't if you have Uniswap. And then, but you still cross-chain, you need something. And then now,
right.
You know, cross-chain.
Now you have yeah, exactly. Right. And then, we need to slowly remove all of the Web2 kind of mentality of this entire industry, right? Mm-hmm. Centralized exchanges is one of those things. UIs and domain names and, you know, even something like IPFS to me is not fully decentralized because you have to continue to pay for it in order for it to exist. And, like, I don't like that approach. Like, everything needs to be done in a way that everything is in a Web3 rails and completely very difficult for anybody to censor or insert permission.
Yeah. Well, now let's say, you know, take the discussion a little bit more primitive on the censorship thing and talk about the what happens if they throw a hood over Chad's head and take him off somewhere and say, shut it down now. And, like, basically the more intelligent way of phrasing, the more nuanced way of phrasing that is, ThorChain has a lot of public developers or developers that are probably US-based, or at least people that know for sure that some are or could find them relatively easily, like a state actor, I'm sure. And then just, you know, what is the realistic threat to the actual integrity and decentralization of the protocol if, let's just say, a state actor decides that Thorchain's become too much of a risk and wants to find ways of compromising it and goes after the known developers?
Right. Well, I mean, I don't own it or operate it, and the operation of the network does not rely on me any way, shape, or form. It would continue to function just fine if I was hooded and thrown in the back of a black van and put off to a offsite CIA, you know, whatever the spot thing, whatever they call it. I don't really matter in the context of the operation of the network because I'm not involved with that. What I might matter is like my future contributions to the project might be obviously hindered. So if I have a new idea, you know, 6 months from now, you know, but I'm not able to do it because I've been, you know, locked in jail or whatever, that might be the theoretical downside. But the operation of the network wouldn't do it, and nor would the validator set like, you know, care that I'm in jail. Like, they shouldn't care that I'm in jail. To be honest, they should continue to operate as they see fit for themselves.
Yeah, and so if all known developers that we are all known semi-public developers, you know, get compromised, and maybe it's a more insidious way where they start, you know, pushing in certain changes to the code or something that might have some kind of issue. Like, at some point, how much do we trust the validators to kind of line by line through the code and then have discussions about should we implement this rather than just, oh, these guys make great stuff, we're just gonna, you know, we're just gonna merge and then just run the new version? Like, at what point, how realistic is it that the validators, unless it's something huge like shut down everything and they're just like, no, are they, you know, what's the actual risk of them kind of going along with a compromised development team, you know, the way things have turned out that way?
Yeah, like, hypothetically, if a developer, you know, said, hey, let's implement, you know, from the PR, all that process, right? The network would have to agree to do it, which in that case, I would think they would not. I'd be shocked if they did. I'd be very surprised if they did. I'll say that. I think right now you see a lot of the validators kind of moving with the dev team for most of the time, and that's largely because we're both highly aligned with each other. The dev team is very high aligned with the validators, and vice versa. We all are aiming for the same goal. We want the Thorchain to become highly successful, to be the biggest exchange in crypto, bar none. And we are all, you know, making changes and making, you know, improvements to the protocol, but not all of them are smooth sailing, right? There's a large debate around lending, for example, was a hot topic. There's still a large debate around the algo stable design of Thorchain, whether or not that should be enabled or not, right? And there's now there's a debate about impermanent loss protection, whether or not that should be kind of sunset now that there really isn't much IL in the network at all right now. And that's just an ongoing debate that the community will have to argue for, the validators will have to vote for and come up with whatever answer it is. But I think the validators are not stupid. I think they are well aware of how this works. I can't imagine somebody owning, you know, $3 or $5 million worth of Rune and having no idea about how any of this shit works. Like, that's just kind of that's a kind of a weird mentality to have. I'm just going to YOLO $5 million and not even, you know, understand the thing that I'm investing in. So I think they understand, they have a deep enough understanding to be able to like to fight against, you know, bad ideas, right? But but whenever I come up with an idea, or leading comes with an idea or whatever to change the protocol, to add blending or some other feature, streaming swaps or whatever, we have to, you know, it's not easy for us to do that, to be honest with you. We have to go to the community. We have to like explain the concept and the idea and why it's beneficial and why it works. And, you know, this is why we're not concerned about these failure scenarios, and then effectively convince the entire community that this is a good idea. And that's not always easy, and it's quite stressful and, you know, frustrating at times, to be honest with you. Even within the dev team, like oftentimes, you know, we'll come with an idea like streaming swaps or lending or whatever. And then, you know, a lot of the Nine Realms people will be strongly against it. And so we have to spend a lot of time and energy trying to explain, you know, why it works, blah, blah, blah. And that could be, you know, exhausting in its own right. So even before you even get to the community side, there's already, you know, a good amount of debate happening about these ideas and concepts. But eventually we come to a conclusion or a consensus at some point, and we move forward as the community deems, you know, right for the project.
Yeah, I mean, on this, the streaming swaps kind of thing, was there really much pushback on that? I understand lending, of course, because there's all kinds of ways lending could go. But, like, were there actually a lot of Nine Realms people that were like, I don't think we should do this?
There was. Generally, with almost every feature, there's pushback, to be honest with you.
Well, what's the scale man of the criticism of streaming swaps then?
I think this one of the arguments I heard, I won't mention who, of course, but one of the arguments is that because we weren't seeing much trades above $10,000, that there isn't much demand for more. So we don't need, to according to this person, we don't need more liquidity, we don't need deeper pools, and we don't need streaming swaps. We're already getting what we can get. And I think I obviously strongly disagree with that mentality. And eventually we got through and we learned that people are willing to do $6 million trades, you know, through this protocol, let alone 10,000. So, and obviously we've seen a huge adoption. So that, obviously that mentality didn't, you know, iron out to be an accurate understanding of the market. But generally almost every feature, there's always an argument within the team.
So the argument against was that it wasn't necessarily necessary, but then also it might just like ruin fee revenue for like the little volume that's already there.
That was one of the concerns about ruin fee revenue, that we would reduce the fees but we wouldn't get the additional volume, right? That was one of the arguments or the viewpoints. I think I actually have a bet with one of the persons in Nine Realms that to be honest, I haven't like checked back into the bet. I think we made a bet like within, I think it was like within 1 month, that like half the trade volume would be a streaming swap, because I think he was saying that no one would use it or use very very little.
I mean, so did you win that bet?
Handily. Yeah. I think I won it within a week or two, let alone a month.
Which is, as a side point, I am very much in favor of such bets, because I think that like it kind of, why not put a price tag to your opinions and then just like figure it out, as long as you're not losing your shirt. Bet on these things. Like, I would say, you know, I don't know. It might be very interesting to kind of throw, like, for example, anytime someone says, oh, it's just going to get censored and captured, you won't be able to do anything, whatever. Pick a time frame, pick some criteria, throw some money and just see what happens and just see who's right and who isn't.
Yep. Hold you accountable for your statements, in other words.
Yeah. Someone should make a lot of bets on lending in particular, because that's more one of the more controversial, because it's much more complicated in, I guess, potential areas for risk. And I have to say, like, I think I'm probably finally up to like a 90% understanding of the basics of how the lending thing works. For me, it's moon math. It's a little beyond me in some areas. I'm almost there, but so how, like, now that the theory's out there, now that it's actually been implemented, and it's, I do know personal friends who've used the protocol and, you know, successfully, and, you know, unfortunately used it like right before mm-hmm. ThorSwap went down, and then just wanted to get out. It just had to wait for like a little longer to do that.
A 30-day minimum on loans, yeah.
Yeah, but also I think it was just the inability to access the ThorSwap interface when it was down for a little bit. That just happened to coincide with some stuff. And again,
they could have used lens.io to withdraw as well. Like
they might not. ThorSwap
does not give you in. Yeah, maybe they didn't know about it, but like ThorSwap is nothing gatekeepy about ThorSwap. Mm-hmm. If the UI goes down forever and gets killed, then you can just go ahead and withdraw your LP position or your savers or your loan or whatever it is through some other UI.
Yeah. So how is
lending? Or you can do it by.
So how's it?
Yeah. So lending. So right now, let me pull up my dashboard so I can speak with more affirmation. So we've burnt a total of around 2 million runes so far, bought and burnt off the market at this stage. The lending the cap of it is about 30%, 29%, and 30% full. So we're not even close to getting to the cap of this thing. We've already burnt 2 million. And hypothetically speaking, if 100% of all the loans were closed today, for whatever reason, only about half that room would be minted back. So we would have had a net burn of about a million rune, or a little less than a million rune on the protocol. And that's largely because rune's been doing so well. It's been performing extremely well the last few months, much better than pretty much every other asset in the industry. Actually, I think it is the number one performing asset, literally. And because of that, it's performing so well. Lending is also doing very well with it.
Yeah. So like, just doing well. It's growing. It's working as intended. No red flags. Just like,
no red flags. Everything works as it. Everything worked as it was intended. And once we got streaming loans open, we have saw kind of some larger ones be open, which is a really good thing. I think the thing with right now is just like, we won't really know whether or not lending is successful, in my opinion, until it goes through a full cycle, like full bear, full bull, like that whole full cycle. You won't really know definitively. Do we expect that when things go bear, you know, in what are the 3-4 years, whatever the hell, the next bear market, whatever the hell that's going to be, that things will kind of go kind of south in a way, right? But we're expecting that. We're expecting same thing with ILP. We expect it to kind of go down in bear markets, but it wouldn't be the liability to grow, but the actual realized liability would be probably very small for a host of reasons. Yeah. So that asymmetry is all we need to make sure that over a longer period of time, we're always inching towards the place we want to go to.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be interesting. And so the accounting mechanism for these loans, the flash in the pan stable coin, right? The algo stable is like worked out so far. What do you think are the chances that I know that you've been wanting to do that as like an actual stable, not just a it's there, it's not like a hidden stable. Cause I remember the original design and then I remember the Terra Luna collapse and everyone freaking out. And then I remember like when I saw the way, how it turned out, I'm just like, it's just like, we still need it, but let's just hide it to like, so people don't freak out. And so now that it's a thing, right? Now that it's an actual thing, how have like discussions or whatever advanced towards making something like this an actual algo stable on Thorchain? Are people warming up to it, or is it still like let's wait a few more lending cycles and just see if it doesn't destroy the whole protocol?
Well, so the way that that was stable is called Tor, by the way, T-O-R. Mm-hmm. And Tor is not a general asset. It's just used for accounting purposes for lending. So it can't really collapse the protocol because the market cap of Tor is always zero. So there's no weight to push the price of Rune to zero, as you saw with Luna, because there is no UST in a matter of spec. So it offers not really much of a threat to the protocol right now, for the most part. But I think the value in running it the way it is now is that I can more confidently, and I can show data to the industry, to our community, and we can talk about how effective the peg is, right? Because UST lost its peg, right? Every algo stable is lost its peg at some point in time, and always for a different reason than the previous one, and in a different cause. And the question is like, how strong is our peg? Is a peg really strong or is it really weak? What is it? And so by running it like just in the live on mainnet for a long period of time, for 6 months or a year or you know, whatever it is, we can look at the data and we can see like, well, how well has it performed, right, over that time period? And so far what we've seen is that it's actually extremely hard. It's actually the hardest stable coin we've ever seen in terms of its ability to be pegged to the dollar. And the reason why it's so effective at that, more so than any other stablecoin out there, whether it be centralized, decentralized, over-collateralized, algo, whatever, is because its peg, it comes from like an index of stables, right? Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't have its own peg to maintain the way that UST did, the way that, you know, DAI does, the way that, you know, USDC does. It instead inherits its peg from the totality of the other stablecoins in the industry, right? USDC, USDT, DAI, BUSD, you know, LUSD, I think, PayPal USD, I think might be one of them or something like this. So we can add as many to this index that you want. And so the odds that 51% of the stablecoins are all going to fail simultaneously at the same time is, we've never seen that in the history of crypto. We've seen UST DPEG, we've seen USDC DPEG, we've seen every stablecoin DPEGs up a few cents or down cents at some point. Mm-hmm. But they never do it like at the same time, right? And so we have this ability to use the performance of all the stable coins to figure out what our peg is pushed at. So it's much more stable than any other stable coin out there for that reason. It has to be. It's mathematically determined to be this way.
Of course.
And so that because of that, I feel very confident about this particular pegging mechanism, because it's not trying to hand roll its own thing. It's just inheriting from a myriad of other people who have already been, have strong mechanisms behind them, whether that be USDC or otherwise. So I feel confident about it. And we're seeing that in the graph. And you can go on this dashboards.9realms.com and you can scroll down to the lending thing, and halfway down the page you can actually see the USDC peg and the USDT peg and the BUSD peg. And then the TOR is just like almost like a straight line, like not very little kind of mm-hmm. deviation from the dollar at all, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah. What do you think would be the potential effects of, for example, let's just say the U.S. government deciding to ban the use of unregulated stablecoins, as in from now on, only the Federal Reserve can issue stablecoins. All other ones are illegal. And I'm sure the U.S. based what Tether would probably get destroyed pretty quickly. USDC would go away. There would be a few that wouldn't do so well. But in that kind of scenario, what would you foresee as the immediate short-term kind of effects on something like Tor?
So because we have both centralized and decentralized stablecoins that can mm-hmm. that produce this index, it can survive because of, LAUSD might be a good example of this, or DAI. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, DAI would de-peg as well in that scenario, because
of course
half of its USDC, so it would probably collapse as well. That's why mm-hmm. it's hard to call it a decentralized stablecoin, because it's
sad.
It's leaning on centralized collateral, but LAUSD doesn't do that, right? And there's other ones that don't. And so what we would have to do in that scenario is we would just the ones that de-peg, i.e. USDC and USDT mm-hmm. and whatever else, they would just get removed from the index, and we would add more index from other coins out there, right? Whatever that might be.
Yeah. So pretty much, except for something absolutely catastrophic, which would probably destroy a lot of things other than stable coins, then it's probably pretty rock solid, at least,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even if it did, even if let's just say that 80% of the stable coins in the industry, which would be an insane event, by itself, but let's just mm-hmm. say that happens, then the community, the network, the nodes would be able to just pause lending, all right, temporarily mm-hmm. until we can, fix the issue and, or wait till things kind of calm down and we repeg. But the industry repegs with their stable coins. So it would not be a big deal in my mind. It would just mean that we have to pause lending temporarily until shit, gets, on the floor again, and it's not being thrown around.
Hmm. Yeah. So just a thought that kind of entered my mind, because ultimately stablecoins are nearly 100% USD representations. And, I don't think the US dollar is going to be around forever. And I don't know if fiat's not going to be around forever either. At least that's hopefully why we're all here. But at some point, and also this goes to every single time we get close to a bull market, I get a ton of friends, families, et cetera, asking me about crypto and asking me which one should I buy? And of course I can't answer, because I'm not an investment advisor, et cetera, all the disclaimers, but also I don't know. And it's just really hard to have a good index fund kind of type of thing, especially in a decentralized way. So all that to say, has there ever been a thought to do a non-dollar stable coin or index coin for ThorChain that's a representation of all the liquidity pools?
We actually had this idea a while back, years ago. It's called composites. We called it composites because mm-hmm. it would be it's kind of like an index, but we would just take a bunch of different assets and put it into a basket, and that basket would be what we called a composite. And that would, so we would have blue chip composite. We would have a DeFi composite. We would have a stablecoin deposit, which is what Tor more or less is. We would have, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Who knows, right? Like, you can create arbitrarily anything. We actually have the idea that, like, anybody can create a composite. Like, you could create a composite yourself, mm-hmm. and then you can get your people who like you, like, who like your investment strategies or whatever, and that you would, they would just, like, invest into your composite, and then your composite would have, like, 20% Bitcoin and 30% Dash mm-hmm. and 50% this and that, whatever, like, whatever your kind of structure would be, right? Mm-hmm. We thought about that. The reason why we haven't done it thus far is because we don't really see the idea of an index or composite very much in crypto mm-hmm. today, like even within centralized exchanges. And I don't think there's much demand for that right now. And partly because I think everybody kind of like thinks that 97% of crypto is like just dog shit. And everybody disagrees with what the 3% is. Like, I think it's this and you think it's that and mm-hmm. like whatever it is, right? And so, like, it's hard to do a composite when you believe that the vast majority of people of coins are more or less going to zero for that reason. And so I just don't think it would be a highly demanded or highly utilized feature in this current climate. But that said, your friends that talk to you about crypto in the bull market, like, what should I buy? Like, that's how it is in stock markets, right? Stock markets, you don't buy Apple stock. I mean, some people do, but people don't generally buy Apple stock. What they buy is an ETF, or they buy an index or a mutual fund to mm-hmm. invest into, you know, the S&P, right? Or tech stocks. And that is actually inherently a problem in itself, because you are ballooning up shitty stocks that don't have good, you know, fundamentals, because you're investing into a bunch of them. You know who you're investing into. You're just buying, okay, all of these tech stocks, whatever these tech stocks are. And then you're just like ballooning up the value of some company that is not going to be doing well at all. And so it creates a poor price discovery on the value of these stocks in the market. So it's actually counterproductively, it actually harms the market in some ways.
Yeah. It's so a composite rather than like a specific, you know, tradable asset kind of thing might end up turning out into more of like a recommendation list from a trusted investor kind of thing, where it's just
theoretically
go to Thorchain and see these ones, put like $100 each into these and 50 into these, and then just multiplier by however much you need to invest right now, and then
right, so
there you go, and put them in liquidity pools and savers or whatever else, and then
right, so you would walk up to a composite and you would have $1,000 of USDC, let's just say. And you give it to the protocol. The protocol knows that this composite is comprised of these percentage of these different assets. It swaps the USDC into Bitcoin, into ETH, into whatever other assets in this composite is. And then it mints some token, which is the ownership of this composite, and you get it back in your Thor address. And that's how it more or less would have worked if we had done that feature.
Yeah. But so like to have a non-composite, like as far as like a UI, when you entered in the composite, it would automatically broadcast the transactions to in all the pools to get positions right. in all the pools. So you don't have a composite, you have literal real positions in all these pools or all these, you know, savers, vaults or whatever it ends up being. And then just there you go. It kind of automates it, but it's still, you don't have to actually mint a composite where, you know, we have like weird.
Well, you're talking about something slightly different. You're talking about
I'm talking adding, about both, to be honest.
adding liquidity into the pool to get yield on that, right? So you're exposed to Rune, you're exposed to Bitcoin, ETH, and USDC or whatever the composite assets are composed of, and you're just an LP in all of the pools, right?
Yeah.
Depending upon which the composites. That's different from what we were thinking, which was we would just mint a synth, block that synth up into a module, a Cosmos, and you would own that module, some percentage of that module of the value inside that module.
Well, that too, you could do that. Or for example, you could have like an automated thing where you invest in the 5 blue chip assets and you get each one of those is half LP, half savers. So you're getting yield from all of it, but like it's the risk mitigation is kind of there and, you know, just something like that. That would be, I think, it sounds like that'd be more of like a fun thing for UIs to play with than like actual like the minting of the composite asset and whatever goes along with that.
Yep.
Yeah, so I've noticed that the ecosystem beyond Thorchain is also starting to heat up. So I think it was like, I don't know if it, I don't think it was last time, but it was maybe the time before last that we chatted. You mentioned other projects. You happened to mention, oh, there's this team doing like the Maya protocol stuff, and I was just like, really? So, and I go look into it, getting involved with helping that team out, kind of finesse the kind of a deal with the Dash integration kind of thing. Try to get the crypto boomers in the Dash world to like wake up and smell the DeFi and like come with a modern era and like just all that stuff. So I'm kind of pretty familiar with the way the Maya protocol's done pretty well, all things considered, that it's so new, et cetera, et cetera. But first of all, what other Thor children, let's call them, what other Thor children are there out there? I don't know if you know all of them, the canon situation. But like,
Yeah,
how many?
there's a handful.
Yeah, and how have they been doing? You want to give, as far as the overview of the Thor Children report?
Well, Maya is the only one that's like live, right, so far. And they it took them a long time to get to that point. And to be honest, like the Thorchain code is not a simple code base. It's very hard to
I've
understand. So
noticed.
anybody who's willing to fork that and run their own protocol is, you have to give them props, right? Because that sounds a lot easier than it actually is. So Maya's the only one that's forked the code directly into doing it. Sarai is another one where I think they're rewriting everything into Rust and rebuilding it. And I think they're
It's
specifically
cool.
focused
All the
on.
cool kids are doing Rust rewrites these days.
I guess so. As an engineer, I vehemently I'm opposed to it to some degree because it makes sense to rewrite things when there's a reason to do so. But if your reason is I like this language, that's not a very good reason to do it. But Sarai, is working on their thing, which I think is going to be Monero focused. I don't know how far down the long, like the I don't know when their launch is, but and I think the closest one, the next one is Chainflip, and Chainflip is not a fork of the code, but a fork of the white paper, and then they made a few like modifications and changes to it. Like they don't use special signatures. They use something called Frost, which is a kind of a derivative of Schnorr signatures. They used USDC as the base asset in all the pools rather than their own token, which is called Flip. So they made a handful of changes as well. But I think they're starting to launch now, or at least in the next few weeks, and they probably will be live with trading maybe by the end of the year, possibly, And so this is all good stuff too, because we've always wanted to see, and we said, I remember like saying this back in 2020, that like this should be five or six different,
Absolutely.
DEXs out there that allow you to move from chain A to chain B. And what we should do is that all these five DEXs should be friends, and they should like connect to each other and provide liquidity for each other. So like, even with Maya, it'd be great if like we don't support Dash right on Thorchain, but Maya does on Maya protocol. And so if you can connect the two DEXs together, which Maya is working on this, then you can swap, AVAX or something like this on our side through to Rune, and then the Rune goes to Maya, and then the Maya Rune goes to Dash instead of your thing. But it's all just like so fluid and just like and borderless in a sense, and like just magically just moves through each other. Like that's what we want the UI to be. Like I have AVAX and I want Dash. Give me this thing, and you don't really care like how it happens, but you just care that it happens, and but you want good price execution. So the UI will just kind of make it so that we remove all the complexities around these things, and you just kind of have to worry about what you want to get. Similar to like a car, when you're driving a car, you don't really know about pistons, you don't really know about carburetors, you don't know about all these things, but you know about the steering wheel and you know about the pedals, and that's all you really care about, right? And so it should be the same
Oil,
thing.
gas, air
Oil,
filter. Maybe
gas,
that's
air
it.
filter, that's more or less it. Beyond that, you don't really need to understand it. And so like all the DEXs, so Chainflip and Maya and Thorchain and Sarai and like whatever other ones that come downstream, or like Layer Zero, like Osmosis, enter DEX here. They should all be friends. They should all be connected to each other. They should all be in a single transaction, be able to go from anywhere to anywhere in a single transaction from the user's perspective. That would be absolute beauty. Because think about this, like all the centralized exchanges are enemies, right? They're not friends with each other. They don't use each other's liquidity. That's crazy. They would never do such a thing. That would be an anti, you know, corporate mentality or capitalistic mentality. Mm-hmm. That's a terrible idea from their perspectives. And so they can never compete with DEXs because we are working with each other. We're openless. We're permissionless. We can connect to each other and arbitrarily use each other's liquidity. And that's much more powerful and actually beneficial for the user than Coinbase saying, no, 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 you can only trade the assets we want you to trade, and you can't do this and you can't do that and blah, 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 like all these kind of like red tape being thrown up. So eventually, if we can get the DEXs to not be dicks and just be like friends with each other and connect with each other. And
DEX
and
not dicks. That could be a yeah, shirt.
DEX not, yeah, DEXs not dicks. Yeah, like, that'd be a great shirt, actually. And if we can do that, then we could create a, almost like a utopia in some sense, right? Like that we can just have this kind of instant liquidity for any asset you want, whenever the fuck you want, and you get the really great price execution and all these things. Like, that would be amazing. And then the sexes would be just destroyed. Like, they would, who the hell would want to use these kind of closed off red tape fuckeries that are such as exchanges, when you can just instantaneously and quickly and efficiently just get what you want and get better execution than you can on a sex? Like, who would want the sex at that point?
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty good segue into the next thing, which is, I noticed from a very early stage in crypto, I guess, Binance started migrating to their own decentralized, you know, chain or whatever. They started running to like the corporate blockchain sort of thing. And then now you see, of course, Base from Coinbase doing a lot of the same things. And you see a lot. And then, you know, Trust Wallet is using ThorChain backend. And you obviously, like, Edge is like throwing in ThorChain, talking about Maya, doing like, removing this, the centralized exchange plumbing, and just kind of doing that kind of stuff. And one of the reasons I'm like a big fan of Thor Wallet in particular is because Thor Wallet not only supports ThorChain and Maya, but it kind of is like a Coinbase style app almost, mm-hmm. but fully self-custodial and fully running on decentralized exchange rails and just with a fiat on-ramp and stuff. And so that got me thinking, is this going to be the way? Because businesses with a lot of money don't just like lose all their money unless they really have to. They find a way to like stay in the game even if the game changes. So I guess as the game is changing this much, what do you think about the prospects of, say, let's just say Poloniex or something like that deciding to, you know what, all our crypto to crypto trading stuff, we're just going to plug into ThorChain and all be a DEX aggregator backend. Customers won't know the difference, but we're going to get rid of all that annoying like counterparty risk, all the security problems, all the regulatory issues that come with all that, and just plug in and, you know, kind of do things that way. So do you think this is going to happen? Do you think this is happening?
It's not happening. I think it will happen eventually, to be honest with you. I think if you are an institutional corporation of some kind, or institutional investor, there's regulations around like what kind of capital you can interact with. Like, some people can't swap on ThorChain because there's no KYC of the LPs who provide liquidity, right? Mm-hmm. And so that becomes a problem. I think eventually the governments will kind of align themselves to the mentality of DeFi and the mentality of crypto. It sounds it's kind of a hot take, but it sounds a little bit ridiculous, but I think once they realize that it creates a much more efficient market and it's a safer market in many respects. Like, we keep on seeing centralized exchanges, you know, get completely rugged. Obviously, FTX is the most recent example, but that's certainly not the first one, and it certainly won't be the last one either. And when you have a DEX like, let's take Uniswap for example, or Bancorp, because they're very old. Mm-hmm. That have, you know, been proven, been around for a long period of time. Nobody's going to rug Uniswap V2, for example, right? Or even V3. It's just like, it's been around. It's pretty hardened, you know, like it's fucking hardcore, right? It's a really well done exchange. And it's much safer to exchange on that than it is on Coinbase, because Coinbase might rug you. Not to them, but they will. I'm not, you know, Coinbase is a good company and all these things, but like you never know. And so it's like, even as from a government perspective, it's cheaper to do this, because am I going to spend lots of money trying to investigate Coinbases and FTXs and, you know, mm-hmm. go through these legal procedures?
Rather just pay chain analysis to just like tell them what's going on the entire
platform. Yeah, rather than chain analysis doing it, or just like, you know what, everybody just use Uniswap. Mm-hmm. I don't, there's nobody to investigate. There's nothing to, everything's in clear text, right? I have instantaneous real time information about every trade that's happening. Like it's, yeah. I don't have to subpoena Coinbase anymore and go through legal procedures and blah, blah, blah. Like it's actually much more efficient for them. So that it benefits them. Like these systems, like DEXs are like honeypots for governments in many respects, because you have that clarity, that instantaneous real time clarity, which is very valuable for them. Right. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have that in order to stay up with you need that real time aspect. You can't regulate DeFi and like, you know, a week later, like it's just, by that time, everything's already gone. Right. Like it's just not very effective. So eventually I think governments will shift. Right now they can't see it because now crypto is like the devil, you know, according to Elizabeth Warren.
Outside of their control.
Yeah, it's out of their control. They see it as this kind of mystery thing with a bunch of scams and, you know, and Terrors and FTXs and Mt. Coxes and, you know, Quadriga, you know, this kind of stuff. And they see it as this big thing of scammery and this kind of thing, which, to be fair, a big chunk of it is. But like, that's also what happens in technology. Like whenever you have some sort of massive revolution in technology, you're going to see a huge quantity of scams. And like, you're going to start seeing that in the AI world, right? Very much so. Where you're going to see that. You saw that with railroads. You saw that with the internet. You saw that with the telegraph. Like it's just a normal thing to happen when you have a huge influx of capital into a very new technology that nobody really understands how it's going to be utilized. Mm-hmm. Like nobody really understood what even trains were going to be utilized. Obviously it's for like moving things, but like people didn't understand how that could affect economies of like, now farmers can sell their things to a much larger audience, which changes the game of like of producing goods, right? And the kind of the Gilded Age. But I think eventually, once the politicians of today are not 90 years old, because they all are now, unfortunate. Like every politician these days is like in their fucking 90s and they can barely even function or even complete sentences without like getting completely lost in where the hell they're talking about. But eventually that'll shift, hopefully, and we'll have a younger, more privy, Congress and House of Representatives. And that will shift. I think that'll shift, but it won't be tomorrow. It'll be like maybe 10, 20 years from now, we'll start to see that shift.
Yeah, which just on a side tangent on that, it is kind of funny to see the generations. I mean, I'm kind of long in the tooth in the crypto world, like been using crypto for 10 years, a little over 10 years now. And it's funny to see each new generation of crypto users, like the lessons they're with and like some of the struggles with like the, you know, been around since 2014, 15, like Dash community has been like, no, it's like, this is how a liquidity pool works. And like, I don't understand. like just trying to get, because it's not necessarily like a biological age thing, but it's like an age in the space kind of a thing. Yeah. And unfortunately, like the world changes really fast these days, really fast. And the people, generations don't change that fast. And so I guess government kind of changes as fast as the generations change. So
pretty much, yeah. Like,
if young people are using crypto, which some of them are, it's still not everyone, but like if like people in their 20s and early 30s and stuff are using crypto, we just have to wait until they're the guys who comprise the majority of government positions to get to that stage of wherever we were at in terms of government policy.
Yeah. But,
you know, again, I don't really care too much about government policy more than I need to.
Yeah, nor do I. I try to keep my nose out of that world and stay focused on trying to produce something that benefit society in one form or another. But I think one of the to kind of touch upon something you said there is that like one of the fascinating things about crypto in general is that each time we have a cycle, right, it attracts a new type of person that, you know, that wasn't attracted before, right? Like in the early days of crypto, it was like a cryptographic experiment, and it attracted cryptographers of like this general idea of like of a blockchain, right? And then in the next cycle, it started pulling in like libertarians, right? Like a lot of the OG people, like Eric Voorhees, for example, is a libertarian, and a lot of people in those, like, you know, talking about sound money, right? And that was like the big kind of message at the time. And then later on, it was like DeFi and loans and other things. And then another one was like NFTs. And then another thing is this. And so like we're expanding over time all the reasons why crypto is useful. If you're a libertarian, if you're a cryptographer, if you're a finance person, you like art, you like blah, 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 whatever. And we keep on kind of creating these kind of like pathways to kind of attract new audiences to get involved in the space, which I think is quite brilliant. It's like one of the arguments of why crypto will become so readily available everywhere and permeate throughout the entire like society is that it's just going to expand the reasons why you want to use it. And the AI is the same way. AI will expand it. The reasons why you want to use AI, and it would be utilized by everybody because it's just growing the different ways that it has a value, that are value proposition.
Yeah, it's so kind of like bonus question I thought of is the Bitcoin maximalist question, because that definitely fits into the boomer sort of mentality. But
yep.
Thorchain has been one of the most interesting things I've seen as far as Bitcoiners is concerned, because regular Bitcoiners just, they're chill. They understand what's going on. Yeah.
So I'm just pouring some water.
Yeah, no problem. There we go. So the Maxis are obviously, you know, don't believe in other chains. It's like a religious tenet that they can't believe in other chains. It's not just that they think Bitcoin's the best asset, but it's they can't touch other chains unless they're yep. a centralized exchange. But that's a different story. But the point is, Thorchain, I have noticed, has caused a lot of like mental conflicts with that specific group of people, because here you are making Bitcoin better to where you can earn interest and yield on your Bitcoin and keep it in Bitcoin, and where you can swap into stable and then back out again, and where like all this kind of stuff. Although if you don't care about other assets, it's limited, but at least you can get paid by people who do through savers. Mm-hmm. That's like the very minimum. And it's just really hard. It's a really hard kind of like mental switch to be like, all our shit coins to like all but this one are shit coins.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you, what's been just, you know, unscientifically just interacting with Maxis on Twitter, getting their minds blown, seeing them say dumb things in returns.
Yeah.
Have you seen any kind of a progress in the Maxi world as far as in relation to Thorchain?
Not really yet. I'm hopeful that it'll change, but I think one of the funny things is that like a lot of the things that Thorchain is doing is what BlockFi did right before it, you know, collapsed. And it's doing it in a way that's completely transparent, completely like verifiable, completely decentralized, non-KYC, borderless, all these things. And it does it better than BlockFi did it. Like we have our, you know, our savers is turns a much higher yield than the interest on BlockFi if you deposit your Bitcoin. And we do loans, we do all these things. And it's comical to me when Maxis are like, because they were big fans of BlockFi, right? You would have, you know, Peter McCormick, you know, talk about BlockFi all the time. Yeah. And you had like,
I mean, we have to say they were big fans of BlockFi, but they're rewriting history on that for sure.
Sure.
There's no way of, oh, I was wrong. It's like, no, yeah. It's like, because part of the thing is if it was a shitcoin or a scam, then you can't be a maxi. And so you have, in order to continue being a maxi, you have to have never, you have to be pure and righteous.
But the funny thing is that like, if you're using BlockFi to get Bitcoin yield, for example, you are not a maxi because you are relying on centralized entities to hold your, that hold your Bitcoin for you. And you know, they could run off and do all crazy stuff with it and go to zero, which obviously is actually what happened in the end. Right. So, it's very comical to me that as a maxi be like, I'm not going to use Thorchain, even though it's decentralized, even though it's verifiable and all these things, and upholds the standards of the Satoshi white paper better than BlockFi does by a fucking shit ton. But I'm still going to use BlockFi because I'm a maxi, and that's not, you know, going against, you know, maxism, although it inherently does. So it's just kind of this mental disconnect that was almost like comical to see people argue it. And then the other thing that was very comical about maxi mentality that is just completely illogical is that there's never been a technology that, at least not that I'm able to think of, that has ever had a single use case. Every technology we've ever done always is a multitude of places you could use it. And why did you want to use this technology? Whether it be a wheel, whether it be a hammer, whether it be, you know, and almost every technology grows and evolves. Even the wheel has changed over, you know, over thousands of years. It's improved in many ways over a thousand years. It didn't have rubber wheels, and it was just a, you know, a piece of wood initially, right? For example. So every technology, A, grows and adopts and evolves. That's how technology it works. And B, all of your technology is used for a multitude of purposes and reasons, right? And so that's and blockchain is just another type of technology, specifically a very a type of database. And you can use that database for, you know, whatever you want to use it for, as long as you pull upon the attributes that are really nice about that database. So in our case, it's censorship resistant, permissionless, these kind of things. So if you have a database that requires those attributes, blockchain is a really good use case. And money is one of those use cases. Store of value, another use case, right? NFTs, another use case, right? Fucking DeFi, fucking, you know, lots of things in the world can be used. A lot of things can be used. I don't think like social media should be used for this case, my personal opinion, but somebody could use it for that case too. Like it's up to the individual, right? So Maxiism is going to continue to be a problem in the industry for a long time, I'm sure. But most people are not going to be Maxis, right? I think into the future. A lot of people are Maxis because they get burnt in a bear market, right? Peter McCormick is a good example of that. You initially held Bitcoin, a bunch of different coins in the 2017, you know, ICO mania scenario we had. And he got burned a lot of ICOs, as a lot of people did. And he just became a Bitcoin Maxi from that experience. But that's also like a little bit silly to me, just because whenever you have a Darwinistic system like crypto is, where you're born into a malicious, you know, dangerous place, naturally most things are going to die and fail. And you just hope that it's not the things that you are invested in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing with at some point, like as far as I know, there's not a lot of like Maxi approved yield sources today. Like I don't think there's a BlockFi successor people are using. The centralized services people are using are either, well, we need a centralized Lightning wallet in order to transact cheaply, or oh, we need a Swan Bitcoin or something to sell us, you know, to get fiat into Bitcoin, which is not something that Thorchain can really do at this point. No. But the one thing you can do is, you know, actual decentralized yield, but also the lending thing, which is, again, we're talking something that even like modern DeFi people might not fully understand how it works. Definitely not going to get a dinosaur to understand this. But as far as it can be trusted, if it becomes trusted long enough, and some people are like, well, I have a big Bitcoin stash, I don't want to sell the bottom. It's like part of the it's like, do you balance in your, you know, 10 commandments of maximalism? Do you balance like using, which is a worse sin, using a shitcoin or selling at the bottom? Because sometimes you might have to sell at the bottom. And if you can use the shitcoin, you can't sell. You don't have to sell at the bottom. And so that'll be an interesting dynamic. I mean,
yeah, you
know, it's not really important at all, but I just, you know, I like a little drama in my life once in a while, so why not bring it up? So,
welcome to crypto.
Yeah. So, what's the future outlook for Thorchain? Like, what are some of the interesting features on the horizon, and just other big things that you can kind of see in the next couple of years?
Yeah. So, right now we're focused on just like scalability and improving kind of efficiency of the network in many respects. That'll probably be something we'll be focused. The next two major features that we have planned is what we call memoless transactions. And memoless transactions allow you to swap a Thorchain from any wallet in the world. It doesn't have to be a Thorchain supported wallet like ThorSwap or ThorWallet or what have you. It can be, you know, any arbitrary wallet in the world. That's one of the things. And then after that, I think would probably be limit orders. And limit orders is really good because it allows people to use Thorchain in a more professional environment. Right now, it's like really just like a market buys, more or less. And to allow, like, think of it this way, like every exchange in the world, every central exchange has like a simple UI and then like the pro interface, right?
Yeah.
Simple UI, just like, I just want to swap my Bitcoin for Ethereum, whatever it is, and just like a few buttons to click and you're done and you execute the trade. Whereas the pro interface gives you all these charts and like, you know, order book, you know, like, you know, staircases going in both directions and order book depths and that kind of stuff. And people can kind of create orders and constantly buy and trade and for more professional traders. And so I think Thorchain needs to do the same thing as what centralized exchanges do, and have UIs that are simple and clean for somebody who just wants to do a quick trade, And then also have another UI you can go to if you are like a more of a trader and you want more powerful functionalities that allow you to do like shorts and sells and limits and market orders and, you know, all sorts of different kind of stuff. So I think that's really key. And then what's really beneficial about limit orders, it's actually what I'm actually really kind of jazzed about in a sense, is that limit orders allow the arbitrage bots to arbitrage with a limit order rather than just like a swap. And so they can act, they can arbitrage proactively rather than reactively, which is actually really, really important because we were talking about streaming swaps and how that just kind of pulls the streaming swap over a longer period of time. But theoretically with a limit order, and you could actually have a streaming swap against a limit order and actually have a streaming swap done, you know, 10 swaps within a single block. So you have this like instantaneous trade in terms of time, but you get the price exposure, the price execution of a streaming swap. So you get the best of both worlds, right? Yeah. Which is, I think would be very, very positive for the market.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty, you know, exciting, especially considering how far we've come already with all the other features and things like that. So it's shill o'clock right now. What are you going to shill other than the store chain? Where people can follow you at C Bearford on Twitter.
Yep.
Which, you know, it's always a fun time. Anything else?
Yeah, if I can shill something right real quick, would be the other project that I'm working on called Arkeo. It's on Twitter at Arkeo Network, A-R-K-E-O Network. You can go there and kind of follow. And right now we're in a public test net and, you know, just kicking the tires and making sure everything is working as expected and so forth and so on and getting audits done and that kind of stuff. But we should be hopefully, you know, launching mainnet, you know, probably next year. And I think that'll be a really beneficial thing for the industry to create a new missing piece of infrastructure, a truly decentralized infrastructure would be critical for the market.
Yeah. Well, it sounds fantastic. I just followed the account, so I'll keep up on whatever else happens. So
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks for stopping in and taking some time. This has been a great chat. And yeah, everyone else have a good one.
Later, guys.